Welcome to Spark Your Fire Podcast, sparking your interest in Australian property and finance. Here's your hosts, Jazz and David.
Hi everyone, welcome to another episode of Spark Your Fire. I'm your host, David Shee, and we've got Jazz Dana and one of our recurring investors that's coming back onto our show today. And the reason why we want to bring him back on is just because we've had some very positive feedback in relation to our recent deal analysis, or, you know, why we purchased the deal and what's the rationale behind it. That's proven to be quite popular, and now we want to be able to do a bit more. And that's why today we have got Arjun Paliwal back onto the show. Arjun, how are you?
Hey guys, good to be back on again.
Excellent. We love it. We love it. And Jazz, you're also here with us today.
I think so, David. I'm trying to make my presence felt here somehow. How's things, everyone? Arjun, how are you doing? Good.
Very good, my friend. Thanks again, mate, for having me on.
That's all good. So there's this deal that you've done, Arjun, which is very interesting. And recently what we have done is David and I, we have gone on to discussing a particular investment property that an investor has bought in a bit more detail. So unpacking a whole investment property, what was the rationale behind purchasing that particular one rather than going through the whole portfolio, which we still do. But on occasional basis, we want to discuss that as well to give more insights to our listeners. So just on this one, Arjun, so there was this property that you purchased in Tasmania, right?
That's right.
Right. So give us a little bit of insight. First of all, why did we go into Tasmania to purchase a property? Why Tassie?
Well, I was at this stage in my portfolio where, you know, you look at it and you reflect and you go, okay, I've added one, then the second, then the third, then the fourth. But all this talk about, you know, passive incomes coming from real estate and all that sort of stuff, it wasn't being seen on paper. It just didn't feel right. I thought, okay, well, must be long term. And then I calculated everything and I said, hold on a minute. It doesn't matter if I pay $1 extra or $1,000 extra per month. Unless the loan is gone, for the next 30 years, the repayment will be the same unless I refinance or restructure or recast, right? Mm-hmm. So when that came to mind, I thought, look, this traditional way of just adding investment after investment and saying I'll get to financial freedom and passive income is not going to work unless you hold it out for your 30 years, pay off your debt, or you refinance and restructure your debt, or you sell something off, or many years later rents increase, and then that way that gap is created in the income, right? So then what I decided to do was, okay, well, why don't I fast track that by adding an asset with that higher income now? And I'm not talking about neutral gearing or slightly positive gearing. I was talking about really fast-tracking it from high yields. And I felt comfortable to think, well, I've built up enough of an asset base to go onto that journey without feeling like, am I compromising on one or the other? That wasn't going to worry me about the common consensus out there. I felt like this part of my portfolio needed that extra shift to be able to really hit those goals faster. Otherwise, I'd have to wait up for much longer term, which is not a bad thing, but it's just something I didn't want to do. So that then led me, guys, to think of Tasmania because of the yield environments there, the tight supply that was there, which meant that, you know, even the smallest upticks in demand could make a very big difference. And then there's lifestyle factors and other things there that, you know, people wanted to have and they enjoyed. So that's when I think this deal really unpacked itself and Tassie came into sight.
So sounds like this one was purely a yield play, which took you to Tassie, essentially, right?
Initially, that's what I was thinking, but it actually ended up being more than just that.
Right, because I was
right, the Tassie wave too, isn't it?
Exactly.
Because I was going to ask, I mean, in terms of the yield, normally this is a residential property in Tasmania, right?
Correct.
So in terms of the yield, normally you will go more into the commercial space to get the rent yield rather than going into the resi, because commercial normally leaves you with a decent rent yield, but you do sacrifice to some extent on the capital gain side of thing. And obviously the financing, you have to come up with a more deposit. So why didn't you opt for commercial over residential before actually we go into the actual property that you bought?
That's a very, very good question, Jazz, because I was a big believer that at one stage commercial was going to play an important part. but I feel like there was a few residential type of properties that I could still get my hands on before I made the switch. And when I think about the flow of residential, you've got your bread and butter deals, which is like your house or townhouse or single unit, right? They're very bread and butter. They're your basic deals. And then you can start to transition to uptick the cash flow a little bit when you think of duplexes, dual key or occupancies, and maybe house with a granny. Then you sort of go one more level up, and that's when you get to, you know, triplexes, and then you also get to unit blocks of fours. And then one more level up above that, you start to do some alternate residential deals where you start to look at boarding properties, rooming, Airbnb, and some unique strategies. So still the asset class is fully residential, right? So I felt that there was still some room for me to try in that residential space and create what I call a hedge. And for me, what I mean by the hedge is if I have so many residential rentals or so many residential tenancies, as we know, it's more common for someone to want a roof on their head rather than, you know, a business premise over their head, right? And then for that purpose, it felt more powerful for me to add a few more residential properties before I made the shift. So when I did go to commercial, I didn't really mind about the risks that came with it or the lack of capital growth in some portions or the lending in the deposit, because I felt I'd build that hub up for residential property. So that's why I didn't make that shift into commercial just then.
Right. So the main purpose, one of the main reasons being that commercial is a little harder to rent if it gets if it's vacant compared to residential, which can be much faster. Right. That's one of the reasons, right?
So it's
right,
basically okay. Risk, isn't it? So you wanna make sure that you continue to grow your nest egg and to basically lower your risk before you start jumping into the commercial space.
Oh, exactly, David, because I think like there was no hesitation in jumping into commercial, and I still really love that asset class and will continue to invest in that direction. However, I wanted to invest in that way with no looking back. And to do that, I felt by adding some residential portfolios to manage risk, that would be good.
Sure. Fair enough. So let's take us into this deal, mate, that you did in Tasmania. Which year was this in?
So this was late 2017, mm-hmm. and this was in the market of Burnie. And Burnie is not a huge place. So it was, you know, a coastal town in northern Tasmania, about 35 minutes or so from, you know, your Devonport, and then just over an hour and a bit from Launceston. So it's across that coastal line in your three key cities on that northern Tasmania, where you've got Launceston, Devonport, and Burnie. For those who don't know Burnie, Burnie's widely known for having the cruise terminal or cruise stop-off for many boats that come into Tassie. And it's got a mix of industries from your basic retails to your agricultural to a few other things as well that are tourism and other parts there, right? And so why I looked at Burnie to begin with was, you know, I was looking at it from a few different things. So demand, supply, and the confidence. I mean, you know, every single data point to look at firstly was very tight. I mean, vacancy rates in most of the cities was under one. You know, there was a high owner-occupied proportion. And although infrastructure dollar was small, it was high in comparison to previous years, because we have to look at things with relativity, right? It doesn't matter if something is spending big every single year if it's the same. What's different? So the difference here was there was not as much spending, but then there was a lot of now spending on the wharf terminal upgrade, a few other parks and beach lands and things that were improving what people really like in Burnie and enjoying it. And so that's when that relativity-wise, although population wasn't huge, well, it was high in terms of comparison to demand. Okay, infrastructure wasn't huge, but it was high in comparison to previous years. You know, these price growth and things weren't huge, but certain statistics around how tight the market was tighter now than in previous years. So that really led me to go, okay, I feel confident that I could enter into this without my cash flows or things being majorly disrupted, because at the same time, it wasn't just one sort of job market. It was a mix of many little job markets. So that was my, I guess, high-level thoughts of going into there. And then when I looked at other markets around it, I thought, okay, well, Hobart's going off pretty gangbusters. It's pretty fast in terms of the rise. And I'm sure based on supply levels, it may continue. However, I don't want to be going into something where I have this untouched sort of area here where I feel that may provide some of those similar results when people sort of tap out of that Hobart market, they might start to look up north. And that actually eventually happened. You know, people were looking into that Launceston, Devonport, and now even Burnie. And that was coming off the back of people starting to see the heat or what's changing in that sort of Hobart environment. And that really started off in terms of the analysis of what I was looking for and why Burnie and the place itself. And then from there, it was basically now going into the property type. I knew I wanted to have a multi-dwelling property, diversify my number of rents before I go into commercial, add a number of tenants that, you know, the more tenants you have, the more you can increase if the market is right, because even a small $5 increase across, say, four tenants is about $20 in a week, which is not a very small amount. It's a good amount from a rental amount. And so all these things started to factor into play, Jazz, and that's when it got me into looking into that market deeper.
Right. So roughly how much time did you actually spend looking at all these different data points before you decided that Burnie was the or Tassie was the place to invest? I mean, did you spend a month, 3 months? For someone who's starting their investment journey or someone who's never bought a property in Tassie, as an example, me, right? I mean, how much time do you actually spend on just doing that research groundwork before picking up the area?
So the good news was that before purchasing this, I had relied on some professional support to help me with three properties. And so I'd started to go through that phase of using a buyer's agent multiple times. They had guided me through that journey. I'd understood a lot about what they do and don't do. And then from there, I combined it with my knowledge that was growing over time. So I wouldn't say it's the norm in terms of, you know, how fast that decision was made, but it helped because I was experiencing all these learnings along the way. So it took roughly about 3 months of hardcore digging. And when you consider that, I mean, I think that's kind of pretty fast when you consider, you know, how I'm in full-time employment, I was working, I had my, obviously my partner, my family commitments. So 3 months felt like it was a pretty good time. And that's how long it took to come together from, okay, the type of deal I'm trying to work for and the type of deal I landed on.
Sure. Right. Okay. But with the deal, take us into the deal, mate. So you finalized the area, Burnie, and then you started looking at the properties, or you were looking at properties in the other parts of Tasmania as well while you were more interested in Burnie, or it was just that now Burnie is the place and this is where I'm going to start hunting the properties now?
It was actually a bit of Burnie and Launceston where I'd come down to my top two. I actually, before going into this one, put an offer on a three dwelling place in Launceston. But basically what happened was with that Launceston property, everything was ticking out. It was multiple rentals, you know, high income, a suburb where I felt capital growth could be strong, all those factors I was talking about before. But where the deal dropped for me was, Jez, that at that deal, when we got to the lawyer reviewing everything, we found out the way those two other dwellings were set up as part of that three were not council approved. And so we didn't want to go into that risk of going, okay, well, we buy it and then we hope nothing happens to us. Or we buy it and, you know, we have to do all these fix-ups and things down the track. So we dropped the deal in Launceston and then I said, all right, well, now that one's dropped. Let me go to this one in Burnie. So it was a bit of a blessing in disguise that I went to this one in Burnie because of that dropped deal. And then when I look at this deal itself, I was then just looking for that same brief of multiple properties, triplex, duplex, or fourplex, right? And I came across this over 800 square meter land, four units on the block, all separately titled with lots of cosmetic renovation and improvement opportunity. The cosmetic improvements didn't need to be done to go and live there. It was already rentable and being rented. And I felt a little bit fishy about the deal, to be honest, because I was like, hold on a minute. This has been on market for now 10 months, like 11 months. What's happening? What have I missed here? Like, this sounds too good to be true. And then I found out that, you know, like from the agent and things like that, that they just weren't budging on their price initially. And only in the recent month have they come down to budge on it. And it was a sale where there were four people as part of a fund. And unfortunately, one of the people in that super fund passed away. And it was a husband and wife, and then a brother and the wife. And so the wife had said, look, you know, with my husband passing, I want to liquidate this and bring it back to our respective, you know, superannuation accounts and so forth. And that was an agreed decision, but I think there was some back and forths going on during that period, as well as the prices that they weren't agreeing on. So I then, you know, really stuck in and said, okay, look, you got to look past this whole being on market for some time. You've analyzed the deal and you do like it. And that's when this property, which has 3 2-bedrooms and 1 1-bedroom, all in a row, 4 on over 800 square meters of land with close to 9% yields, was on the market. So we kept negotiating hard, and eventually from your 410, 420, I was able to pick it down at 365,000. So that was a major steal in my eyes in terms of that bargain. And it's been performing really, really well since then.
Right, 365K from 410 to 420. That's a good negotiation that you ended up doing. And a 9% yield, that's a gross yield of 9%, right?
Correct. And that's across the 4 tenancies.
Right, okay. And you said that to the property, there was a bit of cosmetic renovations required as well.
That's right. So I think there's a lot of opportunity here where basically what I did was I found that the undermarket value positioning would be very strong in both its current condition as well as what I could do to it. And what I started to do was I realized that, yes, at the time of buy, this is going to be considered as one block, because even if it's on separate titles, I'm buying it all. They don't want to sell it individually. And what that means is I'm unlikely to have the bank go and value it, you know, for what the values are for each property at the time of buy, because they've got the contract of sale for what the purchase price is, right? And from there, I started to look at, okay, well, that's not going to be the case after I settle. So what I started to do is I started to look around for similar one-bed and two-bed apartments in a similar condition. And I was really shocked to see that on an individual level, all these properties were actually, you know, renting at yields of 6.5% to 7%. So I'm already buying at a bulk with yields of 2% higher. And that, when you work the values out backwards, starts to help out significantly. And so then I realized that point. Then I said, okay, but let me look at my future potential. What if I do up all the concreting in the driveway, repaint the exterior, strip some of the kitchen and carpeting and put in new flooring and redo up the kitchen, and then, you know, improve the bathroom by doing a facelift and give it a carport improvement as well. Like, yes, it sounds like a lot to do, but when you're doing it over a block of four, the cost starts to separate out, right? So then I realized, okay, when I look at it from that perspective, now there's units in that nicer condition renting at 5% to 6% yields. And that's when I really, I guess, got excited, and I started to go, this is really the deal that I want, because my worst case is I'm already under market value when I revalue them individually. And my best case is that I'm going to be significantly in front through some strategic renovation down the track. So that's where I then, you know, jumped in on the negotiations and got all that happening, and we secured the deal.
Right. So 365K was the purchase price. And have you got it re-evaluated since then? What's the current valuation on this property?
Yeah. So what I did was, firstly, two things happened since then. Number one was I decided to revalue each unit individually. And that really helped the assessment be not a purchase of a block, but this is a unit on its own title, one bedder, and let's now compare it to other one bedders. This is a unit on its title, two bedder. Let's now compare it to other two bedders. And from that revaluation on that individual analysis, not from the block bulk discounting, all the total values came up to be in the high 500s. So when you consider the 365 in the high 500s, that becomes a really solid difference, which I was very pleased with, because not just from that market, under market purchase, but actually the Burnie market has been taking off over the last year and a bit. So that helped a lot as well.
Arjun, do you have to strata title these units in order to be able to get them valued individually?
So they were already on separate titles at the time of purchase, David, which does obviously have its con of increased outgoings, right? However, when it considers the yield and the cash flow, that really got eaten up pretty easily because of the high rents.
Yeah.
And the other thing is, because I own all four of them, it's not like there's a body corp or anything set up in the middle that we got to pay. I just take care of all the repairs for the block, right?
Yeah.
But the main thing, David, which really helped me think past that, was that coming back to the rental increases, obviously the market really heated up. Vacancy rates were under 1% at that point, and things were very tight. So what that did for me was made me realize, okay, well, there's some room to increase rents here without me hesitating. And at the same time, if one tenant does say, nope, not for me, then I've still got three tenants there, right? And yep. You don't have that same luxury with a house. Because sometimes you wonder, oh, look, do I want to really increase it? What if it goes vacant? What about the vacancy rate? Do I want to wait that long? Is it worth the income that drops? Over here, you can take a bit more risk in that. So by doing that across the four, my rents that were sitting at around 685 or 680 when I first purchased are now sitting at over 720. So just like that, that's what the power of that scalability does when you have four. And so when you have a $10 increase, it's actually 40 or 35 if the $1 one bedroom doesn't increase by much, right? So yeah. That's where you've got that power of scale, which really helped me outweigh all these body corp costs and things like, not non-body corp, sorry, the separate title costs.
You're the body corp, mate. You're the body corp. Don't increase the cost yourself. Increase the rent, not the cost, mate.
That's right. So that really helped me out from that cash flow perspective. And now it's in a position to pay itself P&I and all the outgoings and extra on top.
Oh, wow. That's awesome. So basically what you're saying is when you pick up the unit, it was already individually titled. So there were four separate units on four separate titles, but it was one contract of sale, basically.
Correct. One contract of sale with all the title particulars noted in that.
Okay. And was it purchased in the self-managed super fund before by the previous owner? Sounds like it was an SMSF type of setup.
Exactly. Yes. It looked like it was an SMSF type before from what we saw in the title search, as well as what the agents had told us.
Very good. I think this is a great example in terms of, you know, like multiple rental incomes. You know, at most, I think, you know, this is the type of deal that every investor would have dreamt of having one. I don't know, Jazz. I wouldn't mind picking up a couple myself.
I was going to throw offer to Arjun to sell it for $300,000.
I was shocked to see that it was on the market for that long. And I think sometimes when deals are too good to be true, some people actually avoid them. And I also think sometimes when they're not in your traditional capital city locations, people actually avoid them as well. So I think that's a bit of a blessing in disguise where, you know, people felt unsure of what's happening and why it's happening. And whereas I actually have a bit of a different mentality where, you know, coming from New Zealand, every place in Australia looks pretty big to me. So when I was looking around, I didn't have the same bias that said, oh my God, what's happening in that regional town? But what about the capital? I was like, look, just show me the numbers and let's figure it out from there.
David, we should move to New Zealand for a little while. Maybe we'll start investing a little bit more.
Man, I lived in Auckland for 5 years, mate, and I moved here. What are you talking about, James? Come on.
That's really good, mate. So what's happening with it currently? So it's obviously tenanted nicely. No issues with the tenants, I'm assuming?
Yeah, look, no issues with the tenants. Repairs have been close to minimal. I've had, you know, tenants increase the rents and they've been more than happy to, you know, I'm not sure if they're happy, but I mean, they've been more than, going along with it, and they've gone through with it because the options out there, we're not increasing it just for the sake of it. We're looking at comparables. And at the same time, cash flow is coming in and it's paying the loan down itself and giving me income on top of paying itself. So I think now the yield, if you look back and say, what's the yield based on the purchase price, it's now over 10%.
Nice.
Amazing. That's very good. Both yield and growth.
Yeah, and I think in the future, what I'd like to do now is really look to, you know, recast that equity inside there and start to eventually look to renovate the whole deal and bump up the rent from there, as well as, the value that comes from it based on what's happening.
Yeah. So just on the renovation side, Arjun, I mean, when you picked up this deal, you knew that there was some renovation work required to it. What kind of renovation work was it, and what kind of value can it add to it once the renovations are complete? Do you have any idea on that, or you haven't really digged into that side just yet?
Well, let's have a look at the numbers from what I've digged into so far. So firstly, at the time of buy, I felt that there was nothing to do for me to increase the, you know, chances of livability or rentability, right? It was already all tenanted at the time of buy, which is a dream. Everything was tenanted. So from that perspective, I felt like, okay, there is cosmetic potential rather than me having to do anything. So that was part one, which excited me. When I looked at it, there was units in Burnie that, you know, two bettors that were actually, you know, going for anywhere between 150 up to about 295 in just really well renovated units, right? Depending on location and how well renovated or how new they were. So now if you split my 365 across these four, of which three of them are two bettors, I believe that puts them all at the under 100K just, you know, for all of them. So just based on, you know, some spruce ups and things here, if I can work to achieve myself to have these properties in that value range that I provided before, then that obviously has major upside when you do it at scale across four, right? So I think when I look at it, that was high level numbers that I'd looked at. But in terms of what could be done, well, the driveway could be improved. The painting of the exterior of the building could be redone. And then as for the interior, they're very, you know, old school kitchen cabinets and you know, oven stove and very, you know, simple setup and an old finish in the bathroom. Carpets are pretty average. So I think all that, it could almost be given a full refresh. And with that in mind, I feel like that would really add to the values. But at the same time, I feel like you've got to be mindful of renovating or improving affordable properties, because, you know, they're affordable for a reason, and it's not like the incomes or it's not like the suburb is built around it for it to have sustained, you know, expenses at a high purchase price or a high rent. So you've got to be mindful. I think that's the biggest thing, because I mean, just on a personal level, I've had many clients even look at renovating properties in the northern suburbs of Adelaide, and when you consider these properties have buy-in prices of 200 and something, and you know, you can buy new properties equivalent in the high 200s. So when you start renovating it, what are you trying to achieve? So I think that's one thing I have to be mindful of and keep in mind of the suburb and what they're willing to pay, able to pay, without over capitalizing on my renovation.
Some good points over there. Or maybe it's just me. I always think about that Tassie is a very is sort of a retirement place, and it's not one of the best places to invest. So for the listeners who are listening to this, is now still a good time to be investing in Tassie based on your research, or the time as the board has already left? What's the current situation with Tassie?
Firstly, if I go into the history of Tassie and where it's at now, let's look at some data that I actually shared not too long ago. The ABS statistics show Melbourne as an example, since you brought up the Victorian market. Melbourne has had a capital growth of about 5.7% per annum for the last 30 years, right?
Mm-hmm.
And that's obviously as a city, so it doesn't represent where you may buy in that one suburb on the street. But let's just take this broader example for now. What many people thought in saying that, oh, well, Hobart only had that one spike, it's not going to have capital growth. Over the last 30 years, amongst all capital cities, Hobart has had 6.1% per annum growth. So when you think of Sydney, that was 5%, Brisbane, 5.3%, Adelaide, 5.2%, Darwin, 5%, Melbourne and Canberra, 5.7%, Perth was in the fives as well, and Hobart, 6.1%. So I think it's fair to say the myth has been busted of Tassie being a long-term market, because over the 30 years it has done it, but it's not as smooth or consistent or as, I guess, linear as you know, some of the other cities have been in the capital environments. Now, coming fast-forwarding now to the now, right? Naturally, when you have such rapid price growth over the few years, Hobart becomes something interesting to think of when you go, wait, how long has something got in terms of that steam left in it? Now, there are always going to be pockets in every area where the ripple hasn't hit, and I think those are still out there. And then at the same time, there'll be unique types of deals that you can do, whether it be renovate or flips or something in that type of environment, they'll still catch attention. Because supply, or the problem for supply in Tassie, has not been solved yet. There isn't a mass amount of units everywhere or anything to control that demand, so it's still pretty hot. However, it is slowing down considerably from before. Now, another thing I've been looking at is the building approvals in Tassie of late have picked up pretty quickly. So I think that's something to be mindful of when looking at it and not expecting this capital growth to go in the same way, right? So that's the thoughts on Tassie overall, but I still do believe there are pockets in Launceston, pockets in Burnie, in these northern markets that still have a bit of heat left in them. And it's just about finding where and what your strategy is and why you're going to buy there.
Right. So once again, it's about time in the market, not timing the market. And Adelaide being especially one of those markets where if you hold on for long and based on your stats of ABS, it does stack up.
Yeah, well, Adelaide was 5.2% per annum capital growth over the last 30 years, and that's 0.2 ahead of Sydney. But obviously, there'll be suburbs when things just don't do that at all, and there'll be suburbs within them that have overshot that massively. But as a city overall, spot on, Jazz, over the last 30 years, which is a good analysis to look at because our mortgages we take out are 30 years, right? And if we keep talking long-term, what is defined as long-term? It's different for everyone, but I think 30 years is a good number because, you know, if you're buying it for that retirement, and even if you start at, you know, 30 or 40, that couples down pretty well towards that retirement age.
Sure. Not that I have got anything against ABS, but I sometimes do doubt the stats that they print. A lot of the times it feels like that they are screwed up to some extent. I'm not trying to challenge it, but just saying that I always doubt these stats that come out of ABS, to be honest.
Yeah, it's a funny world of statistics, right? I mean, we've got RP data saying something, we've got, you know, ABS saying something, we've got realestate.com.au saying Melbourne never really declined much. We've got other places saying Melbourne dropped by 20 or 10. So it's funny. Like, I think that's one thing, if there was an improvement that could be made in Australia, is getting a consistent set of data that we can all be like, hey, that's just what it is.
Yeah, and especially when you start doing the averages, that just completely screws up the things, because the Melbourne market, I mean, there's anywhere from 60 million to 100 million property down to
exactly
$150,000 or $60,000 property. The stats just don't add up, to be honest. So it's always a struggle to understand these stats. But you're right, they vary between these different statistical companies like CoreLogic, CopyData, SQM Research and all. It just doesn't make much sense. But back to the site made for quickly before we run out of time. Are you now that you have tasted this multi-unit site that you have bought, which was already started, which was already a strata, do you think that is more of the direction you will head in for you and for your investors who you help down the line? Because there's some good quick buck to be made out of that, and it's the whole project is to some extent is in your control because you're holding the all the units.
Yeah, that's a very valid point. So I think it still comes down to that individual person strategy, right? And that's where I feel like investing based on your risk appetite can be a big thing to consider. I feel that if you look at the left side of a line and then the right side, you've got this path that you can take. And we start off with like your bread and butter deals to get you comfortable with investing in real estate, understanding, you know, the capital growth fundamentals, minimizing risk. And they're your houses, townhouses, units, right? And then you start to move down this line of duplexes, dual occupancies, granny flat deals, triplexes, unit blocks of four like I've just purchased here. And then you even start to go down the line even further where you start to get pretty alternate with your residential, where you might do, you know, subdivide, you know, flips, you know, renovate and flips. You might do subdivide, renovate, hold, or Airbnbs or boarding or all these other things. And then you start moving away from residential and going commercial. So people have different start and stop points of where they are. But I really do feel that these types of properties need to be considered in most people's portfolio eventually, whether it be, you know, your second year in or whether it be your 10th or 20th year in. I think having these type of properties can really quickly and rapidly boost up your incomes, reduce your risk, and also help you take control of what you'd like to do with your land rather than being one unit. You're actually the block.
No, that's awesome. Arjun, that was some great insight into the property that you have bought, and it's definitely a good buy by the sounds of it. Four unit site, and fully under your control in this case. Some reno and more value can be added onto it. Leased at 9% rent yield. That all sounds pretty good, mate. Anything else, David, that we want to cover from this particular investment property story?
No, I think that's a good coverage so far, so we should be good.
All right, cool. Arjun, any other wise words of wisdom for the investors out there or people starting the journey?
Yeah, sure. So thanks, guys, again, for having me on. And the biggest things I can share from my sort of experience is we live in a huge, massive, diverse, and rich country. And in doing that, you know, you could be living in a small city or a big city. Make the whole country your investing decision. Like, don't be zoned in on your backyard. Don't be zoned in on a big city. Don't be zoned in on where you heard about that next hotspot. Really consider the country and then go down to a micro level of where you want to analyze. Doing it that way will mean these type of deals don't just become a once-in-a-lifetime type of deal. They become the norm because you really do not have any bias or location sort of bias attached. It's an investment at the end of the day. To be honest, would I go live in my unit block right now? No, I wouldn't. But someone else would. So I think someone else you need to cater for, because you don't buy for yourself. You actually buy for the tenant, and the tenant is the one who makes you rich, not anyone else. So you need to really respect your tenants, look after them, buy for them, not buy for your own self.
Look, thanks for being on the show once again. For our listeners, hope you guys are enjoying the content. If you guys are, please don't forget to give us a 5-star rating on iTunes. And we will see you guys next time. Jazz and David.
If you have any questions or feedback about today's episode, you can reach out to us through Spark Your Fire Podcast. podcast@gmail.com. That's Spark Your Fire Podcast, all one word, @gmail.com. Also, the content discussed in this episode is general in nature. Please seek specific advice from qualified professionals in regards to your personal situation.